It's called the Science Podcast, a couple of atheists that run this podcast. So I thought you'd be interested to hear what they say. This is only one little bit, so it's over half an hour, and I couldn't play you the whole thing because I'd have to have so many beeps in it bleeping out the expletives.
Tonight's episode of the Science Enthusiast Podcast is brought to you by the Maplewood, Missouri Department of Tourism. Domestic abuse is a sensitive subject, and all good Maplewoodians, because I guess I don't know what you call somebody from Maplewood, Maplewoodians, know how to keep their mouth shut about domestic violence. That's why in Maplewood, Missouri, it's an actual fucking law that you can't call law enforcement more than two times in a 180-day period to report domestic abuse. Otherwise, you might get kicked out of town, which is a real actual thing that happened, and I am not making this up. Because after all, what better way to prevent the hassle of ensuring the safety of domestic abuse victims than just making them go away?
What happened to her?
She moved to St. Louis, and her abuser, stabbed her.
Well, Maplewood, fuck you.
Yeah,
I mean... Can I say that? Is that okay? Can I just tell them to go fuck themselves? It's a town.
Real thing.
Real thing.
Real
like,
thing.
You
Real
sent
story.
Me this story. I mean, you sent me a link to this. I looked at the title of the link and was just like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. Then I read it and I was like, you've really got to be fucking kidding me. This is real life.
Nope.
It's not
a
kidding.
Real thing.
Not kidding. So there's that. Hey, nice to see you.
Nice to see you. I mean, We are starting this interview. We just recorded with Dr. David Gorski for
the past hour.
Episode next month. Who knows when that'll
be? Episode something. It's episode something.
Episode 50 something. But now we ended that one talking about physician assisted suicide. So, I mean, why not talk about something equally depressing to start out the show? But, I mean, hello and thank you for listening to the Science Enthusiast Podcast. Or we're sorry, why not both?
We're definitely sorry.
My name is Dan Brobin, and as always, I'm joined by my pretty alt-right friend, Natalie. No,
I didn't. No, this was an old one. This was an old one.
So the again, the integrity was compromised.
No, well, yeah, because I didn't do it. But yeah, I'm Natalie, and I'm really happy to be here with you, Dan, on
episode
49.
She's not a Nazi,
Hashtag I'm not.
Nazi. Natalie, not a Nazi.
Just let's Hashtag not. So not, anyways.
That'll be trending by the morning, even though the episode doesn't come out until noon.
So it's already trending right now.
It's already trending.
It's all over.
Somewhere.
It's
in somewhere. Some alt universe. Oh,
yeah.
Full circle.
Oh, hate mail directed to at NC Newell at Twitter. Let's just get it out of the way now.
Not in this version of the multiverse.
All right. So let's talk about something kind of cool, right? So this is episode 49, Neil Carter's episode. Awesome. Super stoked for people to listen to that interview. But so that means next week we will have done this for 50 episodes, which, I mean, did you think we'd make it to our to this far? Almost a full year.
I didn't think we wouldn't, but there's no reason that we could just do a podcast a day. Doesn't mean anybody wants to listen to it or anybody would download it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, this is it has really no significance other than a cool number, because really people could just hate us, and I mean, I'm sure some of them do. But so anyways, for episode 50,
to what I was saying, because I'm the man, the man saying is always important.
Stop dansplaining me. Stop.
Stop Natalie explaining me. Stop woman explaining me. We a couple weeks ago went over 150,000 all time downloads of the show.
Yay.
So that's not insignificant.
So thanks, guys.
Untold. I don't know. I don't know what's good.
I like that number. I think that sounds fine. Good. It's more than zero. So next week, to celebrate doing 50 episodes and more than zero downloads, we're going to do an Ask Me Anything-ish episode. You know, ask us anything.
I believe the kids call that an AMA.
An AMA. So if you guys have anything you want us to talk about or any questions for us, send a message to us on Facebook,
podcast
or
scienceenthusiast.com, or message us
or that,
on Facebook, or message the Facebook
Twitter
page,
or whatever. Ask us something somewhere on the internet, and we might actually answer it. And give us some stuff to talk about. We're just gonna bullshit with each other for an hour for episode 50. So, you know, really, really sorry already. And so this week, Dan has found a God of the Week. So
I can't take credit for the find. I can't take, I didn't create this God. I didn't.
Well, no one could create this God. You've just chosen to worship
biologically
him.
Biologically speaking, somebody did.
Okay. True. Two because this did. This is an actual human.
Yeah. Our God this week, sort of. He's might be a lizard person. We don't know. We can't prove maybe. He's not. Yeah. Is our God of the Week this week is Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
What's he the god of?
The god of literally not doing your one fucking job and just walking out of a press conference without answering a single goddamn question.
Yeah. And still having the job.
Right. And so I was told about this, that like that happened today. Like today is Tuesday. We're recording Tuesday. It'll come out on Wednesday or whenever you listen to us. But that happened today, Tuesday, May 2nd, in the year of our Spaghetti Monster 2017. Mm-hmm. But so I went to verify this and let me read about this. Let me read what happened. And I couldn't find the story because – well, no, that's not even the thing. The thing is, like, I go to find it and then I see one of the first headlines – Sean Spicer's latest press conference could be his worst yet. Oh, great. I found it. Nope. That's from March 31st. Okay. Sean Spicer held a press conference. He didn't take questions or the whole truth or tell the whole truth. Oh, great. I found it. Nope. That's January 21st. Spicer slams like, reporters, like the, but evidence doesn't match up. Nope. Again,
it's like the hold my beer of press conferences. He's always ready to outdo himself or do nothing or... Yeah.
It's impressive. Like, I wish I could just not do my job and, like, you might get a little, like, shit for it, but, like, still have a job.
Right.
Right?
Right, to just show up, not give a fuck, and then, like, you just get to keep showing up, and you keep, like, and you get to do less and less and less. There are no expectations. Like, you just, you bring the expectations so low.
Right, and they're like Jeff Sessions is prosecuting, the Justice Department is prosecuting somebody for laughing at him during Congress. That's a real thing that's happening. Donald Trump tomorrow is probably going to sign basically a second version, national version of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, only called the Religious Liberty.
Yeah.
Order or whatever. Yeah, because we need more legislation to assert the freedoms that we already have, because that doesn't, like, you know, not make sense at all.
The state of our nation.
Well, and then a couple days ago, we had who was it? I forget who it was. Said, hey, well, Trump has looked into having the ability to sue the press.
The press. I mean,
why do we need any of that?
We're like really, really positive today.
I just, you know, we have a good interview coming up here with
we
Neil,
do.
So
yeah, it's really good.
We'll do that.
So listen, that. Yeah. So, tonight we are thrilled to be joined by Neil Carter. Neil writes the blog Godless in Dixie, which chronicles the thoughts and struggles of a former evangelical Christian learning to relate to life as a skeptic in the Deep South. And I know you do many other things besides that, but welcome, Neil.
Thank you.
Glad to talk to you tonight.
Good to be here.
So, we're gonna start where, I mean, I'm sure you get asked this a lot, just with the kind of blog you write and the work you do, but I want to kind of start with your, like, origin story from, you know, evangelical Christian to where you are now. So can you kind of talk to our audience a little bit about your path from religion to,
Right. Yeah, sure. Well, I grew up in Mississippi and was a Southern Baptist. So my background is very, very evangelical. And I grew up in a mega church, had a lot going on, and you know, I was sort of marginally involved as a child. My family was involved, but it was nominal. And it was around my teenage years at about age 16 that I got saved at a youth evangelism conference. And I hit the ground running. I was gung-ho for my faith and stayed that way for about 20 years. And first thing I did was, besides teaching Bible studies and Sunday school and occasionally going on little evangelism tours and preaching and things like that, was that in college, I minored in Bible because I was told that I could save it for seminary. And then I went to seminary, to Reformed Theological Seminary. So I got a little bit of Baptist, a little bit of Presbyterian. The only major tradition in the Protestant world I didn't get into is the charismatic world. It just didn't really fit me. But anyway, I left the Southern Baptist life in my 20s and joined up with a home church movement. So I really sort of had a broad spectrum of experiences. And the home church experience was part of an experiment myself. You know, I was taught as a Baptist that we were trying to be as New Testament as possible. So I dove into that and studied what the New Testament church was like and decided at one point that home church, something more informal and more participatory, was what I wanted. And I did that for about 10 years. What they don't tell you is that the more serious you are about your faith, the more you start to see where the holes are and have to figure out what to do about that. And that's actually the last post that I wrote was called basically, what did I call it? I don't remember. It was our biggest mistake was we did just as we were told to do. And that was, we read the Bible and we, you know, we studied the New Testament. We studied the church history and we studied theology and we devoted ourselves to it entirely. And it was precisely because we were so into what we were doing that we began to see where the holes were and where the gaps were. So it was in my mid 30s when I finally got to the point that I realized that I didn't really believe everything anymore. You know, it took a number of years for me to get to that point where I had run out of rationalizations. And I've maintained for a long time that the people who hang on to their faith the longest are not the ones who aren't as smart. It's the other way around. Sometimes the smarter you are, the better you are at rationalizing what you believe. So those of us that made it into our 30s or even our 40s, we just got really, really good at rationalizing all of the gaps and holes, you know. And so I have a lot of patience for people who are still in the process of doing that, you know, and very little judgment because, you know, I'm a little bit embarrassed that I made it to 40, to 35 before I really realized that I didn't have good reasons to believe these things anymore. But at that point, my whole life was built around my faith, and it was built around ministry, and it was built around the home church. So when I finally realized I didn't believe it anymore, everything started to fall apart. You know, first thing to go was the social life, because my entire social life was built around church. And all the people that were my closest friends growing up, they're all ministers in different capacities. And, you know, it's not even a matter of a rejection on purpose from anybody. It's just that if church is your whole life, it's really hard to bond over anything, you know, because it's your life. Eventually, my family broke apart as well. That was the most painful part of my story, is that there were a lot of issues that we had to work through. But the biggest issue was that when my wife and I came together, we came together because of a common passion for the Lord, you know, for our faith.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When that was gone, that changed the dynamic entirely, you know. And even when it came to working through our differences, we didn't have a common reference point or framework to appeal to. And sadly, that didn't work. And we tried for about a year to work through our differences and then decided we had to go separate ways. So there's definitely been a lot of loss on my end, and people don't trust you in Mississippi if you're not a devout person, you know.
Yeah.
It's okay if you're just sort of lukewarm, you know, and maybe you're into sports or hunting or whatever, but just not much into church. But to be an actual atheist, you know, to use the A word, that's just going over the line. But for me personally, I had to go in and embrace that identity, because for everyone else where I live, your faith determines everything about who you are. It's like one of the first things they want to know is what kind of church do you belong to. It's in the first two or three questions they ask you when you move to a new area. And so for me, I got to the point where I realized I had to go on and embrace that label. And at first I was closeted, you know, I didn't tell anybody about it, but I was outed by other people. I was teaching middle school a few years back, and one of my students was stalking me on Facebook and found that I had liked several atheist pages. And she came to class the next day and raised her hand and said, "Mr. Carter, are you an atheist?" And I changed the subject, you know, and I eventually they asked again, and I said, "That's really not your business to know what my religious beliefs are. And they were like, why didn't you say no? You know, because every other teacher they have said, oh yeah, I'm a Christian. In fact, most of them are very overt about their faith and they wear it on their sleeves around here. So at any rate, the word got out that I'm an atheist, and that's like up there with child molester and, you know, like drug dealer. No, I'm completely serious.
No, I believe
so
you.
It's just the
subtle irony of like the history of
that escalated
that
quickly,
is the Catholic Church
yeah.
and
yeah.
topic.
Oh,
of
I know.
Podcast.
There's a lot of irony there. Yeah. Well, at any rate, I lost a lot of people's trust very quickly, and I can actually physically see it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, because of where I live, I have to keep this to myself as much as possible. So I started a blog. Now, really, I didn't start out with a blog. You know, at first I was very closeted, but even with the blog, you know, unless you're a blog reader and you like to read skeptic stuff, you know, I'm in a bubble. So it's not like everybody in Jackson, Mississippi would automatically know that I'm an atheist and that I write. In fact, at my current job, I don't even go by the name Neil, because that's my middle name, and I go by my first name. So the students are always trying to pry into my personal life, and I have a Google problem, because now I've done enough things, and I've even been on CBS once, and been on a number of podcasts, and so it's very easy to find me if you search the name Neil Carter. So whenever they ask me, Coach Carter, what's your first name? Mr. Carter, what's your first name? I tell them it's Mr.
That works.
It helps. Yeah, or Coach. And at any rate, it's caused a lot of problems at work, too, because once my principal found out that I was an atheist, she raised it up as an issue. And you're not legally supposed to be able to do
right.
that. She did it
like,
anyway.
What
you're not supposed to be able to.
What it, like, what
How
was,
did it happen?
What was said?
Okay. She came to my classroom. It was the morning after Barack Obama won re-election, as a matter of fact.
So
she was on a
So she's in a bad.
So yeah,
a
I was
going to
say
like,
she was in a really bad mood.
They're well, looking for anybody at that point. Probably.
Yeah, just target practice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I live in a very red state, and if you look at the map, the county that I was teaching in was the reddest of all the counties in the metro area. It's well known. Rankin County Schools, in fact, has made the news a number of times because the American Humanist Association has had to sue them for overt proselytization. But that's where my children were going to school. And I transferred to their school because I wanted to be where they were. So I was trying to be very careful not to rock any boats, make any waves. That's one of the reasons why I didn't protest when she brought this up. But she came in and she was upset. And she told me that she didn't want me talking about politics or religion anymore in my class. So here's the problem. I was teaching history. So I don't know how you're supposed to teach history and not talk about politics or religion.
What does that look like? That's a completely like reimagined or like let's just erase and like black out some things in the textbook. Like
but she just didn't want me addressing the issues because she didn't trust how I would lead the discussion. She thought that I would try to indoctrinate the children into my godless atheism. And I mean, the very next chapter was going to be the history of Christianity, which I was more qualified to teach than anybody at the school because I actually have a graduate degree, you know, in Christian studies and studied a lot of church history. But I'm extremely careful with how objective I am in the way that I teach, way more than the other teachers were. That was the big irony. We had been following the election up until that point, and I had successfully taught a group of seventh graders how to track the Electoral College, which in the last election was actually pretty easy to do. This election was a completely different story. But in the last election, we predicted 50 out of 50 states correctly 2 weeks before the election. We got them all correct. And it wasn't that difficult because it was a different election. It was a different world. And Russian hackers weren't involved. But
well, they're
anyway,
they weren't involved this time. Just microwaves
right.
and...
Right. So at any rate, she said no politics or religion. And when I asked her why that was the case, because that's discriminatory behavior, by the way,
mm-hmm.
Right.
She said, well, there's talk in the community that you told your students you're an atheist. And then she folded her arms and like waited for me to respond.
Like,
and I was and she was tapping her foot. I was so stunned. I didn't know what to say. If I could go back and relive that moment, I would have pushed back immediately and said, are you saying that I'm supposed to teach differently because I have been labeled as a different religious set of beliefs. Anyway, I what I did was I just sat there in stunned silence. She finished her speech and she left, and I emailed her later and I said, let me see if I understand this correctly. And I spelled out what my questions were. Yeah. And she dodged the questions and she said, we'll talk about it in the next meeting. And we didn't. And we didn't in the next one or the next one. So finally, I started trying to go through the appeals process. And this is a very, for the lack of a better word, incestuous county leadership. Yeah.
Everybody all, kind of knows each other. And
they're all related to each other.
Natalie's a former former school admin, and I'm a former teacher at a small rural school in Indiana. So I can...
All of the leadership was related to each other.
Yeah.
So the appeals process was completely non-objective and rigged. I even tried the teachers union, but Mississippi's a right-to-work state, so the teachers unions have no power at all.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, at the end of that year, they told me they weren't bringing me back. And when I asked why, they said, you know, since this is your first year teaching for our system, we don't have to give you a reason. Mm-hmm. Of course, I knew what the reason was because the principal had laid out all of the rules halfway through the year. And not only that, but 2 months later, they moved me out of my history class in the middle of the school year and put me in a math class.
Because they just didn't even want you to have that platform.
Right. So they figured like, I couldn't do any damage in math. I mean, how am I going to bring up atheism in math? Yeah.
This is the atheist theorem that we're talking about.
Right. Hemet, you know, Hemet Mehta also taught math for a while. And his joke was always that, you know, the only chance you get to bring in atheism is when we're talking about imaginary numbers.
Right.
You know, you can say, these numbers are imaginary, just like God.
And just leave that and leave the room. And
And then drop the mic.
That's it. Bye.
So, you know, I decided math actually was a good idea from here on out because I'm less likely to piss off anybody if I'm teaching math. So I went to start working for some inner city school districts. And that's essentially what I'm doing now is I work inner city, lower income, lower performing schools. And I like the school that I'm at right now, actually, even though their scores aren't great. It's some good people. But it's easier to keep a low profile that way, you know, and they're just happy for me to be there and to do my job, and which I love. So it's working out, but I know I can't be out completely about who I am because it always leads to trouble. The last school that I taught at, I would be gone for a conference, and when I came back, kids were carving the name of Jesus into the walls and into the desks.
That's like a little creepy. Like,
how inspired are you?
I came up with a term for it. I called it evangelism.
Ooh. Oh, I have a meme on my phone that says evangelism. Oh, wow.
Well, that was me. I made that up. You're welcome.
Well, thank you, because that's fantastic. But that's really weird.
Well, you know, what happened with that school was that the there's some pretty rough kids, and then there's the good kids. And the good kids are all church-going kids. And they're the ones that kind of keep the bad kids straight whenever they're trying to act up. I mean, the teacher does too. But, like, I would be gone for a conference, and there would be a sub, and it would be up to the good kids to watch the bad kids. But the problem is the good kids, the church-going kids, they found out about the blog into my second year, and they started lecturing me. I mean, I had this one girl come stand over me at my desk one day and tell me that she knew why she was in my classroom. And I said, because you need to learn geometry? And she said, God brought me to this classroom so that I could minister to you and influence you and save you from yourself. And I said, save
sweet
me
child.
From myself?
I'm a child.
Yeah.
That's adorable.
I'm like, honey, I have a child your age and I changed her diapers and anyway.
Just that's interesting
disrespect.
To me though.
Yeah.
Like that, like how bold that is that they feel like just by them having this belief and you heathen atheist teacher, even though you are like, can either of you imagine going up to your teacher and just like, listen, I've got a lecture for you. Like,
right.
Who
yeah,
does
no,
that?
I can't even imagine it. But they felt empowered by their, you know, their pastor's charge to go out and save the lost. So, I've got a post called Christianity Has a Major Boundary Problem.
For real.
And it's about that very thing. It's even children, and I've had my own child at age 11 lecture me about my path that I'm on. And I know why she does it. It's because she goes to a church several times a week and has people telling her people that do not believe in Jesus are going to hell. And I had to sit down one night and tell the youngest child, you know, something comforting, anything I could come up with, when she was in tears telling me that she believed I was going to hell. Mm-hmm. And she had just gotten saved herself and just had a profession of faith, had just gotten baptized. And they were giving her all the new, you know, introductory, you know, lessons about being a new believer. And one of the things they tell you is, and now when you die, you get to go to heaven and be with all your loved ones, all the ones who believe in Jesus at least. And they were like, well, what about Daddy? Well, he doesn't really believe in Jesus. And then the tears start coming. And so one night when it was time for me to put her to bed, she was in tears, clinging to my leg. And I asked her what was wrong. And she explained it's because she didn't think I was going to be with her in heaven. And I had to sit down and try to talk her through that. And obviously, that's not a point where you can start and say, honey, hell is bullshit. I promise it's not real. Like, I can't tell my, whatever, she was, I think, six at the time. I can't tell her that. So this kind of relates to a question that you had sent me before, which was, how do you deal with the people who don't believe? How do you live in an environment that's like that? Especially for children, I'm not going to sweep the legs of their entire belief system as the only person in their life who is a non-believer. That is foolish, because it will not work. You know, that's not even good child psychology. You know, I've had enough psychology and teaching classes to know that the first thing they teach you is that you're supposed to engage prior knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. You start by figuring out what they know and then building on that, rather than trying to come in and introducing an entire new framework that they don't even have hooks for, right? So I started out with what she already believed, which was that God is a father who loves his children. And I began talking her through the idea, excuse me, that if God loves us, then he's not going to let terrible things happen to us. Certainly not just because we don't believe the right things. That doesn't even make any sense. And so we just kind of talked through it. And I know I didn't change her theology, but at least gave her a slightly different perspective to make her a little bit less terrified so that she could go to sleep. That's a difficult position to be in, though.
Yeah, because that just kind of all of that for children and, you know, any teaching around that, like, you have to behave a certain way in order to, like, receive, you know, future rewards, or if you don't believe and you don't behave this certain way, like, there's a really terrible fiery place awaiting you. Like,
it's gonna burn you forever.
Like,
and that's terrifying to a child. And I don't see how that's not like, on some level, of like low key emotional abuse to literally threaten a child that, hey, you need to go save all these people if you care about them. If you don't do that, then that reflects on you because you didn't do your job as a good Christian well enough. So now
dereliction of duty on your part.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and we experience that. People who are deconverts where we are, you probably know what I'm talking about. We experience that from all angles, you know, because there's parents, there's cousins, there's sisters, there's brothers, there's friends, there's classmates, and every one of them feels that God has called them to get you saved again. You're everybody's project.
Yep.
You know, and it doesn't always mean they come at you with coercive, you know, pressuring tactics, but a lot of times in the Deep South, it's very passive aggressive kinds of coercion, you know, and sometimes it's even that they just load you down with sweetness. You know, like, they're super nice to you sometimes. And that is even ickier to me, because I'm like, you know what? Don't be nice to me just because you think it's going to butter me up to get me resaved.
Like, you know? Is it like, do they feel pity for those of us who don't believe? Do they feel responsibility to make more people enter, like, God's heavenly kingdom? And then they get, do they get rewarded better? Like, what do they think about us?
Well, I don't think that it's just about getting trophies per se. I mean, I think there are some people that are looking for notches in their belt. But when we're talking about people that are close to us, like our family, it's just that, you know, they really think that we're going to suffer. And they're afraid that the only way to love us is to make sure we don't suffer. So, of course, they're going to keep pressuring us in a thousand different ways. I mean, in a sense, I kind of can't blame them. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand why they're doing what they're doing. But in another sense, yeah, it's not productive. And I have to sit them down sometimes and tell them, you cannot come at me with these messages because they only backfire. First of all, it won't scare me for you to say that I'm going to hell, because I think that's absurd.
Right? Yeah.
In fact, would you like for me to sit down and break apart why I think hell is absurd? I can start listing the reasons why it doesn't even make any sense. And I could do that. I'm kind of itching to do that the next time somebody in my family wants to do that. But for the most part, I just have to tell them, don't you see how that's counterproductive to come at me with these fear tactics? Number one, it's not fearful for me since I don't even believe in it. And they can't seem to conceptualize that sometimes. Yeah. How can you be afraid of hell if you don't think it's real? But even then, it wouldn't be a successful tactic just to cover somebody with fear, you know? And I know that that must be something that works on them at a level, and that's why they're using it on me. But it, you know, obviously doesn't work on me. There was a time where I would have been scared by that, but I mean, now, like I said, it's just absurd. I've deconstructed the idea to my satisfaction, so it doesn't really hold much power anymore.
And so, like, obviously when people have, you know, this really strong religious belief in it, it's, I mean, it's tied to so many things. It's tied to community. It's tied to their sense of connection to the world and how they live and all this. And then it seems like, okay, that there might be a misconception that we don't really have anything that we're like believing in or like right. living
we
for.
Believe in nothing.
We believe in nothing. I remember when I was working at a private school, I was having a conversation with another teacher, and she was talking about her church, and I was like, yeah, I don't go to church. And she asked me with like this look on her face, like, are you an atheist or something? And I was like, well,
did she whisper the word?
It was like, she actually, it was so bizarre. She backed up slightly. When
yes.
She
they will
it.
Physically get
like,
distance.
They do that. So, and I was like, well, yeah. And so, and then her follow-up question after the look of shock kind of wore off her face, she's like, well, are you telling me that you believe in nothing? And I was like, well, I mean, I don't believe in God like you believe, but like, but I believe in love and each other and like being a good person because like this is all that we have. Like I had to go on this thing where I had to feel, I felt almost like I had to say, yeah, I'm not like some reptilian thing that it's just like, you
but
know,
you can't prove no that feeling. You're not.
We can't prove that I'm not, but like, we'll just go with like, I'm a human. But it was an odd experience because I think there is that quality of like, they don't necessarily get that you can have meaning.
Right. And well, yeah, I mean, ideologically, they've been taught that morality comes from your religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. You know, that they believe that character and ethics and goodness, they're all derivative traits from being connected to Jesus and the Holy Spirit. So if you don't have those things, then obviously you can't access those traits. You know, you could try to maybe mimic them, but even then, you know, it's supposed to fail somehow. And so ideologically, they can't understand, since for them, the morality is always tied to their religious beliefs and it's tied to pleasing God. So if there's no God, then now you feel you can do whatever you want, like murder and rape, as if that's what we want.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they don't understand human nature. And that's part of the problem is one of the central tenets of Christianity is that human nature is terrible. And that is perhaps the most important linchpin belief to Christianity. As much as I don't like to admit it, because progressive Christianity tries to move away from that and have a more positive view of humanity, but they always reach this point where they snap back and say, but there has to be a central need for saving somehow. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any point in Jesus. So that core belief in humanity being bad is just something they can't shake. So you have to have something powerful to overpower that and get you out of it. And that would be the Holy Spirit. So if you don't have that, then you're out of luck. And then if they come from, depending on what kind of tradition they come from, the more fundamentalist traditions also are very literalistic with the way they believe things. I had a little bit of that in my background. They're literalistic in the way they think about end times, you know, eschatology. They're into believing that I read that somewhere in Sweden, they're starting to put microchips in people's hands to track them at work, and they can use it to scan their accounts to buy things. And of course, I had a grandmother that told me that that was going to be the mark of the beast. And to this day, they are certain that the chip is going to be in your hand or in your forehead, and that's going to be the mark of the beast. And they're scared to death. So they're very literalistic the way they read the Bible, looking for like future things. But they're also literalistic when they think about like having spirits inside of you. You've got a spirit in you that God, I guess, put into you when you were born. And when you die, either it's going to leave your body and go to heaven, or usually that's what they think. They're kind of fuzzy at that point, because then what happens to you in the intermediate state? But somehow or another, your spirit goes to heaven. Which means that you've got something inside of you that's alive if you're a Christian. And if you're not a Christian, you either don't even have it, or it's there, but it's like dead. So there's like this whole part of you that doesn't even work. You know, it's like having an organ missing. You know, they're very literalistic, yeah, some people, with the way they think about those things. So when you've got somebody looking at you and you say, I'm an atheist, they suddenly have now shifted into believing you're a different species. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, yeah, you're a completely different species. You lack an entire part of yourself that they have, and they don't know how to relate to you, because to them, everything is geared towards that part of them functioning. If you don't have it, then they don't know what to do with you except try to get you saved.
Well, and then, yeah, and even listening to you talk about how you've had to and still have to sort of hide parts of your work and your identity.
Yes.
I mean, that, like, that to me, because I've felt that too, working, mm-hmm, I live in Maryland, right outside of DC. It's not like a conservative Christian, whatever, but there's definitely a vibe. Like when you're, yeah, when I mean, my job was, I don't do it anymore, but I was the administrator of a small private school. And like, mm, I wasn't necessarily hiding that, right, but I wasn't,
you weren't exactly talking about,
I wasn't
it either,
exactly talking about it either, because there's definitely like that experience I had with a coworker. Mm-hmm. That like, in, ooh, like, who are you type of thing.
Right.
And in, so, even, yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, for me, like, I've never had, even like the worst experience I had whenever like telling somebody I'm atheist or whatever, and maybe it has to do with just how like fucking arrogant I am. But when it was telling my mom, because she, like, of course she cried, and I was like 12 or 13 at the time, and she cried. She was upset because, like we talked about on the episode of the podcast that came out today, I got a message to the page saying, somebody thanking me for causing her to fail as a mother because her child likes my page and is now atheist as a result of my page. And it was like the weirdest like message I think I've ever gotten, but it's like these people, like, they've internalized it so much that they feel like,
yes,
it's a failure. Like she's blaming me for like something that I think is good that we're teaching,
right,
like rational
critical
thought, or
thinking,
we have rational,
yeah,
thinkers, but now that's a bad thing that he's able to think independently and not like be indoctrinated, break that cycle of indoctrination,
right,
there.
Well, they don't think about it as indoctrination. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fascinating sociology that you start to discover experimentally as you come out as an atheist. One of the things you find out is that, first of all, people's religion is very tied to their personal identity.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot question passively or actively their core beliefs without it feeling like a personal attack on them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can try to explain there's a difference between disrespect and disagreement. We should be able to disagree without being disrespectful. But for most of the people I know around here, that does not make any sense. I can say those words, but they just don't see it that way. For them, to disagree with a religious belief is disrespectful. You don't do that out loud. It's fine if you want to do it in the privacy of your own home. You can believe whatever you want because this is Merca. But yeah, you cannot say it out loud. Now, if they want to say their beliefs out loud, that's fine. Actually, it's good. People who go out and demonstrate their beliefs get praised for it around here. Our local business people and politicians, they wear their religion on their sleeves. Mm-hmm. You know, they make a show out of making sure they're in church every Sunday morning. Their commercials during, you know, election season talk about their faith. They'll have a Bible out and they'll read with their family and have a little devotional time on camera, staged for that. You know, it's very central to Southern culture in particular, but it's a part of their identity. And so you cannot say, I don't believe those things without them taking it personally. And another thing that I discovered is how much Greta Christina has talked about this, but religion, it is based on such a flimsy empirical base. You know, it's a social construct. And it's passed along socially, which is why it's so tied to our identity. You know, our parents passed down something to us. And so it's a part of our heritage. And to question that or reject it, much worse, is to reject our heritage, you know, and to it's like a shame on our family. But because it's a social construct, that means the strength of it depends on social consent. You know, there's this unspoken rule that as long as people agree that this deserves respect, then it maintains its strength. But if I step away and say I'm no longer in that camp, I've just removed one notch off of that consent, which means even if I never say a negative word about Christianity and just say I no longer believe, I've now insulted them because I've removed – it's an attack. You know, it's I've taken a leg out from under the table that their faith is resting on because it's a social construct and I'm a part of that social fabric. So when I remove myself, I've just damaged them whether I want to or not. And that's the frustrating thing is I there's no neutral way to be an atheist. You know, Greta Christina's point was that, you know, it's not the same as like sexual orientation. You can tell someone that you're gay, but they don't immediately assume that means that you think they should be gay too, right?
Yeah.
So as offensive as it might be, most people can gather the idea, they can grasp the idea that just because you're gay doesn't mean you think I'm supposed to be gay. But if you say you're atheist, now they feel like you must think they're foolish because you should be the same thing, they should be the same thing you are. You know what I'm saying? It's a totally different dynamic, which means the moment you publicly say you're an atheist, you've now gone up a notch as a villain. You know, before you were just something to be pitied, you know,
yeah.
But now you're an enemy. And I'm talking about, you don't have to be proselytizing. I'm talking about just publicly naming yourself as an atheist. It's an act of war to them. And that means that the moment I came out, I started writing only after I had lost a teaching job. I had lost a family. I had lost pretty much all my friends. Mm-hmm. Again, not entirely their fault. And had lost whole social life, then lost a job. I said, what's there left to lose? I'm going to just start writing again and let whoever finds out, find out. And I've mostly lived that way for the last few years. But then each time I start a new teaching job, I'm quiet for that first year.
Yeah.
Because I need to get past that first year. And then when I'm past that, I can start coming out a little bit more. So hopefully I can come back to the school next year and then I can start coming out a bit more.
So in general, then, like how do we make, I don't know, like, our voices sort of heard and understood better, where we're like, is there a way for us to not be the villains and just like being an atheist? Just it's a normal thing. Like we're just
people. I don't mind the idea of being a villain. I never thought of it like
okay,
that.
Dan
like,
wants to be a super villain, and I'll be.
You want
to
be a villain? That's
he can
great.
Be the villain. I'll be the nice one. I'm.
Right. Yeah. I didn't say I wouldn't be nice. I mean, I'd be nice to be a villain.
We're good cop, bad cop anyways. So
kinda
like
right. Kind of like Gru. Like, he's a villain, but he's nice. But I guess he ends up, I don't know.
Don't spoil.
right. Yeah. Sorry if you haven't seen this movie that's been out for 10 years. My bad.
That's No. They keep making sequels, though, so you never know where he's going to end up. Is he going to be bad again or is he going to be good again? What's this going to be? He's kind of an anti-villain now, isn't he? Well, at any rate, it's very much like that. You know, the superheroes and villains, they have secret identities. And that's kind of what people like me have to do, is we have to keep a couple of identities. We have a very compartmentalized life, and we have to maintain those compartments. I had a conversation with somebody close to me very recently about that very thing, about how difficult it is to come into the life of someone who's as closeted and compartmentalized as I am. It's probably an adjustment for people who aren't used to that. There's a lot of circles that I don't let mix, because if they mix, bad things happen to me, you know, very painful things. So it's an unnatural way to live. How do we make it better? For one thing, doing better PR.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I've gone on record a number of times saying that I favor diplomatic atheism more than the firebrand kind, but I'm also willing to acknowledge the use of firebrand atheism. And it's even kind of a false construct to paint them like they're really two opposite things, because they're not. I mean, I critique religion all the time, which is usually the purview of the firebrand atheist, but I critique it constantly. I just am respectful when I do it. I don't call people stupid. I don't assume that it's a lack of intelligence on their part. And a lot of that's because I'm a former believer myself. So I can only go so far in thinking they're stupid, because I was one of those people too.
Yeah.
You know, the more I insult them, the more I'm insulting my own intelligence. But people who have never been believers in these things, they generally don't understand how it's possible that anybody ever could, unless they're stupid. And I've had to spend a lot of time explaining to people who have never been religious that those of us who were aren't stupid and weren't stupid. We had reasons for believing the things we believed, and I can kind of, you know, lay out what they are for them. But this is one of the reasons why I distinguish between the nuns and the duns. You know, the nuns are the ones who aren't religiously affiliated, but they may not have ever been. And the duns are the ones who were, and now they're just done. You know, and there's a different quality to the way they approach religion and religious discourse, because they generally have an appreciation for an ability to empathize with people who are devout. And we need more of that conversation in public, put out front. And personally, I would like to see that done by the major organizations that do that. You know, like American Atheists, for example. I think American Humanist Association does a pretty decent job of that. They have both sides going. They have the litigious side going, which I think is necessary. Mm-hmm. We do have to fight things in the court, because nobody gives up positions of privilege by asking nice. You know, you have to actually fight them. But, you know, it's like walking softly and carrying a big stick, right? You can take them to court when they are not following the law, and you can be ruthless about that. But you can also be a nice person and not talk down to people. And some people can't handle that. Some people cannot look at a Christian and not insult them. And I just have no patience for that. You know, it's fine if you want to critique religion, but can you not treat the other person with the same amount of respect that you want them to treat you? And so that could help, I think, if we could learn to do that.
And I think it takes all different types of voices to get that message across, because you have to get you have to get attention somehow. So I think it's like you mentioned,
you do.
American Atheists in particular,
they like to do the firebrand approach.
and I mean, but just so it kind of happens that's kind of, you know, how I like to do things too. But I think there's a big difference between I don't know what I would consider myself, but I know most people might consider me to be like firebrand, or we'll say a bit aggressive,
somewhere on that end of the spectrum.
What I say, so that's kind of where I fall. But I'm always, I feel like I'm always extremely clear with anytime I say anything, post anything, or engage any comments. It's always about the ideas, never about the people. Because like you just said, like, I don't think these people are stupid. Like they've been indoctrinated and brainwashed since they were a child, and they've been told this, and they've been since they were a fetus, they were told, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to go to hell, and everybody you love is going to go to hell, and everything's going to be awful because God loves you, but if you don't love him back, you're going to hell. And so I think people who do that are just assholes, and I wouldn't even consider them to be firebrand. They're just assholes. And I think it's great to critique those people, but I think we need that balance. We need people to get the attention, and then we can have people who are more, I guess, calm or not as in your face about things, kind of, you know, either if you want to view it as coming in and cleaning up the mess that they made after we got all these pissed off, Christians now or whatever religion we're discussing, if we want to come in and, you know, clean up that mess, or just, you know, explain in a bit more nuanced fashion. I think. Mm-hmm. Everything like that is beneficial in its own way.
The way that I usually resolve that tension is by describing the firebrand and diplomatic approaches as tools, mm-hmm. in a toolkit, and you use them at different times, you know, based on what's appropriate for the audience. I think that the slash and burn American Atheist approach to billboards that are meant to shock, mm-hmm. and, you know, piss people off, I don't think that works in Jackson, Mississippi. In fact, right now, you can't even get a billboard up in Jackson, Mississippi. You know, we got strip clubs advertising the billboards, but they will not put up an American Atheist billboard. They got one up in Tupelo for, I think, maybe 2 hours.
And that was it. Just like,
and it was taken down. Yeah. And then West Monroe, Louisiana, had one up for a couple of hours, and it was gone. Like, same day. The community just gets so up in arms because they take it as a personal insult to them. Again, the half-naked women on the boards, not so much, but the atheists, even if it's just, you don't believe in God, you're not alone. You know, even that can be offensive. But you know what? At least that is not as much as a slap to people. That's reaching out to the ones who are already on the same side of that aisle and it's more of a positive message, you know? So that kind of approach would be better than the ones that say, skip celebrating Christmas this year. You know it's a myth. Because no, that's not true. In Jackson, Mississippi, most people don't think it's a myth. Mm-hmm. You know, they really believe these things happened. So there has to be a willingness to understand your audience. And I think one approach works in one environment, maybe even on a national stage. But like in a place like the Deep South, I think a diplomatic approach is the only one that will get anywhere because nobody's going to listen to you. You know, there's this thing called the backfire effect, where if you throw out too much at a person that's contradictory to what they believe, they are going to just dig their heels in more and listen to you even less. And you're not getting anywhere. At that point, you're just...
Are we talking about Christians now, or are we talking about Trump supporters in the last election? I'm kind of confused.
Is there a difference?
Well, but it translates to so many things. Because like this kind of conversation, like I think about, you know, some of the stuff I'm working on with like the parenting, and like the movie I'm making focuses on like anti-vaccine and anti-GMO people, and like how do you talk to them and how do you change minds and all of that. And the thing is that there are people like that will never change their minds, and we're not like, let's not fight with them like in internet comments or in real life or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then you have these conversations like geared toward the middle, where you try to be as calm and rational as possible, but also try to find the common ground you have as people as much as possible. Because even though, I mean,
I agree,
like I will differ greatly in so many ways from, say, like, I'm just going to bring it to the sciencey stuff, from like a parent who, you know, believes that like GMOs are the devil. Like, this parent and I are not going to see eye to eye on that, but there are probably so many things that we do have in common, like kids or like where we live or, you know, whatever, where you can have conversations and then you don't have to have the tough ones right away. You get...
Right. Basic people skills can really come in handy.
Yeah. So I think it's that like common ground and communication that translates to so many of these kind of dicier issues, the religion stuff, the like the political stuff, Jesus Christ, of course. And like, and then all like some of these issues around science and pseudoscience and all of that, where it's not just about like, you know, quoting the Bible back at people, or, you know, giving them the results of all these different studies and evidence. It's like, let's be people first, and then let's maybe get to some of these conversations. I don't know. Like,
yeah. Well, but if you've started off by establishing some kind of rapport and relationship, it makes a huge difference. And so, you know, I think you've answered your question there. I think just helping to reestablish that atheists are people too, and they have a lot of the same interests and goals. You know, I think just being a normal, nice person, I think, is the biggest need. And believe it or not, that's a thing you have to say out loud, because people don't seem to get that. Some people feel, honestly, I think what happens is, like you said, some of them are naturally assholes and they like to get a reaction out of people, and they use the firebrand atheism style as a cover for a personality trait that they want validated, and they find validation in that, just like the firebrand preacher does, who's out preaching fire and brimstone. You know, they like authoritarian style leadership, and they've found an umbrella to be under that allows them to use that and to wield that like a weapon over people to make them feel powerful. I think atheists are the same way. I think they have their messages that make them feel like they are in the right. You know, it's a sanctimoniousness, you know, of a different kind. It's an intellectual sanctimoniousness that makes them feel better than everybody else. And that's why they act like assholes, because they need that. They're insecure. And I have no patience for that. You know, there's a point at which I can tell it's crossing that line with some people. And I'm not gonna come behind them and say, okay, you've got your style and I've got mine. When it gets like that, I'm gonna say, no, you're actually undermining everything we're trying to do.
And then I guess like with these conversations or these interactions, I mean, I think obviously I would hope that sometimes people might say, okay, let me think a little bit more critically about whatever topic it is that we're trying to discuss. Like, if say there you were having a conversation with somebody who is like in a similar position to you, kind of like Deep South, questioning their faith, like what advice do you give to that person? Because obviously there's probably compelling reasons to just stay in a religion, in a faith, because of community, because of those kind of things.
We're like,
it's hard. That's a hard one.
And
so what do I tell Dan? What?
Yeah. Where do you go with it? Oh, Dan.
No, I was asking.
Oh, what? I was gonna say, I think that's why so many, you know, I can't speak to, Mississippi and like hardcore, Christian, evangelicalism like that. But I think that's why so many that even have those doubts stay with it is because of that sense of community is, and like you said, like,
sure,
you lost, you feel like, I mean, of course you didn't, but you feel like you lost, you know, everything. And now you're the shell of a person now who has nothing.
Thanks. Gee. Yeah, no, it's a real issue. And because of the number of things that I've lost, I am less likely to encourage people to leave. You know, it's not that I don't think they should follow their conscience, you know, but I do know a little too existentially that if they do leave, there's a good chance that it's going to be a long time before they reestablish a new community if they live around here. Mm-hmm. Now, other parts of the country, maybe not so much, you know, but other parts of the country, they're probably having less of a struggle about that to begin with because they find other things to get involved in. There's a club for this and a group for that, and they're not overtly religious. So there's a lot of places where you can build community. Around here, every sub-community and subculture is so rife with religion that there's almost nowhere to go where you are free from it. You know, you almost have to explicitly create a community for non-believers for that to even exist in any form. And that's problematic too, because now you've got a group that exists solely to validate atheism. And that's a one issue kind of thing. And there's not going to be a lot you have in common. One of your questions that you forwarded had to do with how to engage in politics. And well, it wasn't you. It was someone who commented and added a question in, asked whether politics could be something that's added to our foci as atheists. And my answer to that is, on the one hand, we have to engage in civic engagement. We have to get involved in the civic process or we won't have any influence. But on the other hand, there are not a lot of things we all agree on politically. You know, I mean, the only thing we as a group agree on is atheism. And that's such a small fraction of what it means to be a human. The God question is just one question out of thousands, you know? So there might be more that we have that are not in common as atheists. And so I don't know how well we can organize around political issues if atheism is supposed to be the reason why that group is together.
Right, like that's like our thing is like
we don't believe in God, so that's the main thing.
We all have to agree.
Right.
That's like the entire point.
Right. We don't respond well to instructions being told what we are supposed to believe. But I would say to those people, first of all, that they need to engage in hunting for friends online, for starters. I mean, they need to look for people within their area too, if at all possible. That would be ideal. But it's very hard sometimes to find people in your area who are not Christians. They're out there, but they're all closeted just like you. So if you live in South Georgia somewhere in a small town, you might be the only atheist that you know. And it's not something you can bring up at the coffee table, under the dinner table. You know, like you can't be at a restaurant and go, anybody here an atheist?
And they're just like, you know, no, no.
You,
get away.
No, no. And even the ones that are going to say no, because they don't want to lose everything. But I would say that they need to look online and try to find ways to connect with people. And even though that's less gratifying than people in your vicinity, that might be the best you can get. And the internet is a lifeline for people like us who are in the middle of the Bible Belt or who are even in smaller towns. At least I'm in a big enough town that I could find a couple of dozen people to get together with if we have enough time to plan. That we might not have a ton in common as a group of people, but we at least can commiserate about this one thing. But if you're in a small, tiny town, I would say the internet's going to be a lifeline. You know, following blogs, following podcasts, meeting friends that way, people that are friends of mine on my Facebook wall, I use my wall constantly to try to connect people, like almost like a little community, because I know how many people that are friends of mine don't have any other way to find people but on Facebook walls. And I use a lot of controls for who sees what. Again, it's those compartments. There's a lot of controls about who sees what on my wall so that people can feel safe there. You know, these are the sorts of things you have to do. So I would suggest that finding friends, maybe even getting away to a conference once in a while, because once you get to meet people and you see that you're not alone and you form friendships there that you can build on over time, finding books to read and podcasts to listen to can be a lifeline. Books didn't help me much for whatever reason. Most of the books that I found were written from the perspective of people who had never been a Christian before. And it was a lot more harsh and critical. You know, some of the Four Horsemen, they didn't do
because
anything.
Because you couldn't relate you know, to as, them, right? Because they
their perspective at all. And they couldn't relate to me. Yeah, and I could feel that. And I think anybody else who's struggling with their faith, I think they would probably have a similar experience to me. I think more often than not, they would read the sort of vitriol in Christopher Hitchens' book or maybe one of Dawkins' books, and it just rubs them the wrong way. They're still reading it with like Christian eyes, and they need something that's going to ease them into it. Which is something I want to do. I want to try to write some more that will help introduce people in a gradual way to the process of thinking through them, not trying to push them out the door, but just kind of say, you know what, here's some of the things that you're struggling with, and here's why it's okay to be struggling with those things. So I think finding books, finding podcasts and friends online, getting away to conferences, and then I would not push them to come out too quickly. I usually tell people not to come out unless they've already got, number one, financial independence. So I don't tell 22-year-olds who are still living with their folks to come out to their folks. Yeah. It's not going to go well. Just telling them. They're going to, even if they're nice, they're going to be very, very tempted to use their position of influence and financial independence or dependence to try to coerce you back into believing in Jesus. They will do that, even the nice ones. But the same thing is true for social support as well. If you don't have a large social support network, I would not advise jumping out and telling everybody you're an atheist. Not if you're in like a very religious place. I would tell people to wait until they've got enough of a support network in place that they know they can handle whatever the worst possible backlash could be. And then if they come out and there's no backlash, then great. You know, now they've got a whole bunch of friends that they made, and they spend a whole bunch of time reading books and listening to blogs that or listening to podcasts that help them kind of think through.
Well,
everything.
See, and this is why I really appreciate your approach and why we like to have people on the show who have kind of left religion and tell their stories, because I think it's an accessible way to talk about, you know, lack of belief, that it's a journey from one place to another, and that maybe there's somebody listening who can relate to that, and, you know, and yes, and it doesn't just go to like Dawkins or Hitchens, who I love their books, but I was a different audience. I wasn't coming from that place of like super strong belief ever, really. So I think all of these different perspectives are really important. As we kind of like wrap up now, can you tell everybody where to find you on the internet?
Sure. Okay. Well, I mean, you can just go to godlessanddixie.com for one thing, and that'll bring you to the Pathos page. It'll redirect you. And right now Pathos is hosting Godless and Dixie, which I'm really happy with because they do a good job. There's a lot of ads that you have to fight. But I think they're supposed to be working on a new site design sometime this month, which would be great. A lot of great other people that write for Pathos. And I really like being a part of that community because we kind of push each other and nudge each other. And sometimes we fight each other, but it's always, you know, an intramural fight, even within the different channels. So godlessanddixie.com. There's Twitter, you know, at Godless and Dixie.
Godless and
Dixie. It's a unique name. So once you look it up, you'll find
it. Well, thank you so much for talking to us tonight. And, you know, come back
sometime. Happy to be
here. Talk to us again. All right.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was like fantastic. Yeah.
Cool. I hope we got off the subject a good bit and didn't cover a lot of these questions.
I have that just in case, but like I prefer the ones that like don't really need to like look at, you know, like, oh, what can we talk about for the next like little while? Like
Well, you know, I'm a teacher for a living, so I have no trouble filling
so no,
out.
I really like these conversations. So yeah, this is really good.
Well, I had a good time. Thank you for having me on. Where are you from?
I'm from Connecticut, and I'm in Connecticut right now, actually.
But you sound almost Canadian.
Do
sometimes.
I?
You say a boat. You have this one thing you do with the word about that sounds almost like you're from like Great Lakes, maybe?
No,
like,
I'm from Connecticut. I'm New England.
There's just like this one phrase that you say that sounds almost Canadian.
I could like flee to Canada because of the Donald Trump era, and people would be like, you fit right in. Like, I just
you're
like,
one
I lost,
of us,
my,
right? Come
I lost
on.
My passport, or I lost my Canadian identification or something.
Here's my maple syrup, like, I promise.
I'm good, yeah. So. All right. Well, good to know. I have this accent that I could like
Apparently, just every once in a while. Of course, maybe everybody sounds like that to me because I'm so.
But
far
see,
south.
But and you, I don't. You don't have a super strong southern drawl. I was expecting a little more.
Yeah, I was definitely expecting city, y'all so. And.
Well, I do whip that out, and the more I've had to drink, the more it starts to draw out. But it largely is dependent upon who I'm talking to, and I don't even do that on purpose. But I mimic the way other people talk by habit. So
one question.
That's why it's not so obvious.
One question I wanted to ask you, so we always have a segment because we do. Get a little aggressive about mocking religion here. We always have a God of the Week because if we're going to, like, never run out because there's, like, thousands to choose from and we're not going to do thousands.
Of gods.
So do you have a favorite God that you can think of beyond, of course, the one true God?
Well, so there's some that that I've studied over the years that are kind of fun. God, there's so many different inappropriate ways I could go with that. I like some of the Eastern gods because in Eastern spirituality they blend sexuality and religion a lot more naturally than we do here.
That's been like the last 2 months of gods that we've done. Like it's been
has it.
No. We're not complaining because like it gives us like so much like material.
So
to go
much
off
material,
of. But
there really is. But one of the things that I discovered when I was studying the Book of Galatians is that there is a historical reason why Paul said something about wishing that the Judaizers would castrate themselves. You know, I don't know how much you know about the story of the Book of Galatians, but. The Book of Galatians is written to a church in Asia Minor that's now modern-day Turkey. And at the time, the Jews were coming up from Jerusalem, and they were trying to convince the new Christians, who were Gentiles, that they needed to become Jews. And among the requirements of becoming a Jew is, of course, you have to go under the knife and get circumcised. So if you can imagine being a grown man being told you have to have a bit of your thing cut off,
we could say penis.
That's not a popular.
Adults.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. Anyway, so
it's important. Yeah, it's important to use anatomically correct terms.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm a social worker.
Yeah,
I'm telling you.
Foreskin.
But like,
yeah, you're right. I agree.
Though that's like, yeah,
it's really something. So you know, and Paul, you know, God bless him, understood that there is no way you're going to sell this religion to a world of Gentiles if you have to cut penises as just as a way to get in. So, you know, he revamped the whole thing and said, no. Circumcision was always meant to be a metaphorical thing. It's about putting off the...
So he's
about
like,
putting
is he like
off...
the first, like, this is a metaphor. Like, this is...
Yes, exactly.
The cracker
That's
does not really turn into flesh. It's a metaphor.
Right. He turned the whole thing into a metaphor and it made it acceptable to Gentiles. They're like, oh, so we don't have to get cut on our dicks, you know? At any rate, he says something about wishing the Judaizers would accidentally castrate themselves if they won't shut up about this contention, because many of them believed that they needed to continue making everybody good Jews. Turns out that in that region of the country, there was a god or goddess called Cybele, C-Y-B-E-L-E, and it was more of a matriarchal religion. You know, it was the women who were the priests. And the men were like the servants. They were the peons who did all the hard work and the dirty work. And there was a funny gender-bending sort of tendency among this religion where the women kind of wore the pants in the religion. And the men would grow their fingernails really long, and they would wear like kinds of makeup and long flowing gowns. But one of the things that they wanted the men to do was to castrate themselves. And so the priests of Cybele had to do that. They had to castrate themselves, not just circumcise.
Just like the
castrate.
full Monty. Wow.
They had to become eunuchs. Yeah. They had to become eunuchs to serve the priests, the priestesses. So, yeah, that was pretty wicked religion. And
that's a future feminist want, though.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, yeah. So Paul came to that region and he just, you know, that was one of his first things was, well, you know, why don't you just go the whole way and just cut everything off? You know, if this is what you're going to do. So, you know, he was being metaphorically digging a knife, you know, into them. And, I mean, apparently he was successful because Judaism did not take hold in that area. And Paul's version of Christianity is the one that won. And they reinterpreted Christianity to be about spiritual things instead of, you know, cutting penises and not eating pork.
Wow.
So he was successful. But Cybele is an interesting goddess.
I think I'll be looking her up on Wikipedia and checking her out. And
she's interesting.
Yeah.
One of the things that they did was they would have a bull come stand above the people who were supposed to be forgiven of their sins, and they would cut the throat of the bull. And you would stand under the bull, like there was a grate that you would stand under, and they would let the bull just bleed all over you. And that was how you got washed of your sins. It was part of their rituals.
That's awful.
And you have to go wash the blood off, so then you're washing off.
You do. But it's okay, because now you're spiritually clean. You just, as long as you've, you know, cut your nuts off.
Religion is savage.
Yeah. Isn't it? You know what? Ours is actually not that bad.
That's just a whole other level. Wow.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Wow.
It's a brutish age.
Jesus Christ.
Cybele.
Well, thank you for that, because I will use that for God of the Week. That's, I'm like, I'm all about these really weird. Oh my God!
That's it. So I'm talking about a boat. I'm going to vote that.
Oh God, I'm Canadian.
No Canadian anywhere in your family? Like a grandmother?
No.
Okay.
Unless I need to do like a 23andMe or something.
we're gonna launch an investigation into this. This is gonna be,
I'm not sure genetics getting your accent, but you know, it's worth a try.
Let's pretend. Why we love the internet this week. Again, we started calling this section Why We Love the Internet. It's more just evolving into like the internet. It's a thing that brings us things and ideas. So Emily posted a link for me saying that somebody in the New York Times wrote that like we should say nice stuff about Donald Trump, or like to try to, you know, a challenge, sort of, to say some nice stuff about, say some nice stuff about Donald Trump.
It's filed under positivity, which is
here's the challenge for us is to say some nice things about Donald Trump. And so Emily, who gave this suggestion for this particular reason, we love whatever the internet. So she says, and this is true, that Donald Trump is good at welcoming / complimenting / all around bolstering cruel dictators. Yeah. True. I think
it would be honored to talk to Kim Jong-un. So
yeah. So there's that. I think he's good at just making sure that his kids have jobs.
I think he's good at distracting people from actual problems that he has, or character flaws, or really just life.
I think he has a really good command of American history, particularly the Civil War.
I heard about that yesterday, and I was like, that's enough internet.
That's enough internet. Go home. Go home, America. You're drunk.
You're not even drunk. You're just...
No.
I don't know what the answer
is. I don't know. I don't know. So yeah, guys, like, you should all start saying nice things about Donald Trump, because he is our commander-in-chief, somehow. And I think we could, you know, just instead of even talking, just play some silence, because there's really nothing else good to say. Just have a moment of silence for all the good things about Donald
Trump. We had a moment of silence, so you ruined it. It's ruined.
I ruined everything.
Now.
I'm a woman.
It's ruined.
I'm used to it. Ruined. I'm used to it. So yeah. All right. So we're going to... Now you're gonna thank people for giving us some money, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, and if you like our show, and you, I guess, kind of don't like money, or like want to not have as much money, you can give us money at patreon.com/TSEpodcast, and we give you like stuff early, and we say your names, and I mean, we like you, and then you get into our like super cool Facebook group that is on. I mean, it's on Facebook. So, I mean, that's cool, right? Right, guys?
Yeah. Right? And they just get our love.
Mostly from you, because I have a cold, black, dead heart. But if you want to be just like Michael and Trevor and Nathan and Alice and Crystal and Michael and Michael and Magnus and Savannah, she probably hates me for saying it like that. Everybody hates me, so it's okay. Felix, Amanda, Chris, James, Sarah, and Josue, we would be incredibly grateful. If you don't want to give us money, that's cool too. Just, you know, we appreciate you listening. You can give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, or apparently you can rate us on Facebook. I guess, if you want.
Do it,
I don't know what
maybe.
Good that does. Or check out all the things that we do at scienceenthusiastpodcast.com. Natalie's page, my page, or pages, or the, I mean, we're just kind of everywhere, it feels
there's
like.
There's a lot of places. There's a lot of places on the internet, and we're sorry.
Yeah. God damn.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
It is.
Why don't you hit us with a quote?
All right. So the quote is, "Your actions speak so loud, I can't hear what you're saying." And this quote, so this was put in a Facebook post that, in the comments section of a Facebook post by Neil Carter's girlfriend, Lauren. And she said this was something that her eighth grade teacher, Mr. Horton, used to say a lot. And I just thought it, I like it. I like it because, you know, speak with your actions. Be a good person. Don't be a dick. You can talk all you want, but, you know, be better than that. So this is what's kind of funny too, is I was like, oh, that's cool. I'm going to use it. With a little credit to Mr. Horton. She said Mr. Horton taught at like a religious school, and so I figured, okay, he's definitely never going to listen to this podcast, but supposedly this quote also comes from maybe a Bad Religion song, the like punk band. So interesting, but I liked it. And,
I mean, me just utilizing the internet as we go here, appears to be a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote.
Oh, so it's everywhere. Everyone uses it. Cool, thanks. So, yeah. So there, Neil Carter's lovely girlfriend is represented in this episode too. And next week, come back. We're apologizing in advance because it's just going to be the two of us talking. Yeah.
We talked about like not disparaging ourselves too much.
It's going to be awesome.
It'll be great.
It's gonna be so good. But no, because
I'm
actually
so
it's up to the people that are listening to give us questions and stuff to talk about. So it's actually this show,
really,
it's all on
fault.
Them.
Are you victim blaming right now? Are you victim blaming right now?
Yes, I am. That's what I do. What I do. Oh, hi. Yeah. Have a great week, everybody. Stay safe out there on the internet.
Or don't. I mean, I'm not your dad.
Or don't. We are not their parents.
The music you heard tonight was written and performed by Adam Johnson and was used with his permission. You can contact Adam at adamjohnsondc@gmail.com. This podcast is property of Not Narrow or Straight, LLC, all rights reserved.